This is a Fox News alert. I'm Ashley Strohmeyer live from New York. President Trump just tweeted moments ago that he and the First Lady have tested positive for the coronavirus.
I'd rather not give any specific numbers, but he did have a fever. I don't want to put a percentage on that. I don't want to put a hard date on that. I'm not going to get into all the testing going back. I'm not going to go into specifics.
He has experience now of fighting the coronavirus as an individual. Those firsthand experiences, Joe Biden, he doesn't have those.
President Trump pretended that it was no big deal. But then it landed him in the hospital on supplemental oxygen.
This is not a matter of politics. It's a bracing reminder to all of us that we have to take this virus seriously.
And one thing that's for certain, don't let it dominate you.
This is America Unfiltered, a fresh, raw look at American politics, foreign policy, and media. With me, Liam Kennedy in Dublin.
And with me, Scott Lucas in Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
The past week, Scott, one of the dramatic high points in this wildly popular White House soap opera, The Trump Show. A stricken president does battle with a deadly virus while the nation holds its breath. Sends video messages from a hospital room that looks a lot like the set in Celebrity Apprentice. Takes part in a drive-by photo op, waving to his fans outside the hospital. And then flies to the White House to ascend a balcony, where he slowly removes his mask and salutes a helicopter. What did you think of the show?
Well, crazy just took on a new level over the past week. We had a president who has spent months denying the threat of coronavirus, saying that fear of it is a hoax. And then all of a sudden, he winds up, not only he declaring a positive test, but 34 White House and GOP figures in the past week declaring a positive test. He's the one, however, who ends up in Walter Reed Hospital after receiving oxygen treatment. We spend a weekend wondering if we can trust the doctor's statements about what he's saying. We know that Trump is bored. We know that he's frustrated with the TV coverage. And then on Monday, he gets himself discharged from the hospital so he can do this Mussolini-like appearance before the faithful. I have vanquished coronavirus. And then I'm going to use the words literally from the video he said. Don't be afraid of it. Don't let it dominate you. I may be immune. Now, that's one of two events that I think has played into the campaign of Joe Biden, the Democratic challenger, and Kamala Harris, his vice presidential running mate, with 4 weeks to go before the presidential election. Because I think that first event, that, you know, ongoing drama of Trump, how seriously he was ill, would he be able to come out a changed person to show some sense of humility, connection with the American public? Not a chance. We still don't know how seriously ill he is, because amongst the treatment, the experimental drug he was using, Regeneron, the antiviral drug, remdesivir, he's using steroids, dexamethasone. And that masks the physical effects because it suppresses the infection for a short time. And then, of course, the side effects on top of it are mania and possibly psychosis. So when he went on a tweet storm on Tuesday and said, for example, that's it, no negotiations on a coronavirus relief package with more than 26 million Americans unemployed, when he called the FBI scum, when he said the Food and Drug Administration are involved in a political plot against him because they're insisting on health and safety standards for the vaccine, that doesn't show stability. So rather than benefiting from Trump as the possible person who had beaten coronavirus, or at least was the man who was having to deal with it, now you've got the whole replay of the instability, the denial, the chaos, with all about 212,000 Americans killed, with their relatives watching as he says, don't be afraid of it. Second event, vice presidential debate, then follows after that. Kamala Harris for the Democrats, Vice President Mike Pence. We can debate who won or lost that superficial question. They both were steady in their own way compared to the train wreck of the presidential debate a week earlier. But here's the bottom line. As long as Kamala Harris didn't trip over or basically start throwing things at her opponent across the plexiglass divider, the Democrats, quote, win because the polls have them with expanding leads in not only nationally, but in all the swing states, ahead in 10 of 13 swing states now, and they only need six to win, and two of the other three are toss-ups. And the other reason, coronavirus is now front and center of this election. That was the dominant issue in the debate, with Kamala Harris looking down the barrel of the camera, saying this is the greatest failure in U.S. history by a presidential administration. They have left you to die. They have left you to be ill from this. And Trump and Pence were counting on the fact that coronavirus was not going to be the issue. Supreme Court, war against anarchists, extremists, Democrats, anything but the virus, because it's a hell of a task to win against the pandemic, especially when your leader, well, if you can say he's a leader, is still holed up in the White House.
So you're not taking the read that Trump has beaten the pandemic. You weren't buying into those pictures when he took that mask off. You think the pandemic is still out there fighting away. Okay, fair enough. there are different views on this. My favorite response to Trump on the balcony was not the Mussolini references. It was the Lincoln Project putting out the video of that. And over the top of it, they put the music from Evita, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. I thought that was a bit more subtle. But listen, what that draws us to is something we're going to be talking to an old colleague with today. And that's the question of communication. Because as you say, we are in a moment of chaos. And this chaos is not going to die down over the next few weeks. If anything, it's going to increase. So we turned to Brett Bruen. And Brett was a former senior advisor with the White House administration under Barack Obama. And he's now a major advisor for world leaders on crisis communications. Who better to tell us what the story is going to be and how it's going to be shaped over the next 4 weeks? Brett, thanks for joining us. It's been a week of chaotic communications in the White House, around the White House. You've worked there. How do you see this week in terms of communications? I mean, strategically, tactically, for the White House, but as a space to work, what's your view on that?
Well, I guess let's start there with the White House itself. And what's important for listeners to know is just how small the White House is. It's a quite confined space. In fact, when I was bringing especially foreign visitors into the White House, I had to warn them ahead of time that, you know, it was going to be a disappointment. It, you know, don't blink because you'll miss it, especially when you're walking through the West Wing, which is quite frankly, where most of the work takes place. You have the Situation Room on the ground floor, and then above that, the Oval Office, the Vice President, National Security Advisor, Chief of Staff's office. But these are narrow corridors. They're small offices. Some of them are quite literally closets. So it is a dangerous space to have a virus circulating in. Then on top of that, you know, to the question of the White House's strategic communications, there just hasn't been much. Or they seem to have tried to change the narrative, like with, you know, Trump rolling out to greet his supporters. It backfired, just like it backfired, you know, for him to tear gas the peaceful protesters in Lafayette Park so they could hold up a Bible in front of St. Paul's church. I just think that, you know, they have lost control of the narrative. They are struggling now to try a variety of different tactics, you know, like, you know, Trump has beaten the virus. But as soon as I heard that, I was saying to myself, you know, this can, you know, with one cough, quite easily be undermined. So, you know, why the heck would you roll out this projection of strength when you know there is a significant vulnerability that could be undermined? And, you know, whether it's Trump giving an interview, whether it's, you know, he's committing now to go to the debate. And yet, you know, at any point there, any sign of weakness will be, you know, taken as undermining this argument that, you know, Trump has beaten the virus.
Brett, Mark Meadows is White House Chief of Staff. He's been around D.C. for a while. So, you know, there's that expertise. Is this breakdown we've been seeing because even the Washington insiders are misjudging it? Or is it because this is now a family and friends White House? Or is it just Trump himself barreling over anyone who tries to organize this?
Several agendas at play here. And it was illustrated by the fact that Meadows, just after the president's personal physician briefed reporters with his very upbeat assessment of how things were going, Meadows caught on camera saying, "Hey, can we talk off the record?" And then later attributed directly to him, suggesting that things were much worse. Now, there's been some speculation here in Washington whether that was intentional by the White House or whether it was Meadows trying to boost his own credibility, seeing, you know, the writing on the wall and saying, you know what, this ship is going down. I have to save my own reputation. And I think what we will see more of are those kinds of incidents where some of the administration officials who, you know, are looking at the polls, are looking at Trump's erratic behavior and saying, you know what, this is not a winning ticket in November. So I've got to look beyond. I've got to save my credibility and my reputation. So I think we'll see a whole lot more freelancing in the coming weeks.
That takes us out of the White House and out into the country. It's only a couple of weeks. What do you think will be not just the key strategic messages, but the key methods to deliver them?
Well, we're in this very strange moment where campaigning has been severely restricted. I mean, you can only have a couple dozen people socially distanced, at least on the Biden side of the campaign. Most of the outreach is now virtual. On the Trump, you know, side of the campaign, it's going to be very difficult to go back to those rallies of tens of thousands of people. I mean, it's not to say that Trump, in, you know, his defiance, will not attempt to do so, but I don't think you're going to see quite as many people wanting to go, a bit like the Oklahoma City debacle where, you know, they promised to fill the stadium and it was, you know, less than a third capacity. So I think where we're headed, quite frankly, is a battle over the airwaves, a battle over, you know, these virtual engagements, and that very much favors Joe Biden because Trump is, you know, the person who needs that big platform, who needs to feed off of the audience and the energy. So this is another disadvantage for Trump as he is heading into the home stretch, as he faces a quite significant obstacle in the polls. And I know, and perhaps we'll get into this speculation of, well, the polls were wrong in 2016. So will they be wrong in 2020? And what I would say is, one, a number of things have been corrected, the weighting of how these polls are conducted. But in addition to that, you know, it was largely national polls that were giving Hillary Clinton the victory. Whereas now, if you look at the state-by-state polls, we have shifted from, you know, battleground states where, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, even, you know, states like North Carolina, to Arizona and Texas, where, you know, these are Republican states. So the battleground has moved closer to home for Trump and the Republicans. It is hard to see how you get to a electoral college victory with the current matchup. And let's bear in mind that, you know, in 2016, the election was quite close in a number of these states. Obviously, Hillary Clinton took the national popular vote. And also, there were a lot of people who stayed home, people who even voted for Trump just out of dislike for Hillary. That doesn't apply to Joe Biden. Joe Biden is a much more likable candidate. And we have seen in 2017, in 2018, and in 2019, significant turnout in local, congressional, state elections. I think we are in for a significantly different picture when it comes to voting this year.
It strikes me that you got the sense then that some people see the writing on the wall if this is a straight up election. But are we setting up for a communications battle around a Trump refusal to accept a close election? Are you seeing those lines being set in motion now, or are we just completely going into the unknown on what's going to happen on November 3rd?
You know, we're doing a lot of scenario planning for clients, and the consistent theme in each of them, whether it's a Biden victory, a Trump victory, or this a known outcome where we're dragged into a process that will be deliberated in the courts, potentially deliberated in the streets, is violence. And I think we are facing a very high likelihood that on either side, whether it's on the Democratic side, on the Republican side, there will be a number of violent incidents. They may well be prolonged. And in fact, if you look at polls that show, even since the beginning of the year, Americans on both sides of the political spectrum are increasingly open to using violence to resolve political differences. So this is a very combustible atmosphere. And then on top of that, you do have the potential of Trump, as he claimed in 2016, as he has consistently claimed throughout this campaign, that there will be millions of illegal votes, that the vote by mail is a fraudulent, flawed process. So all of this is creating the predicate for him to deny the outcome of the results. Now, I talked to Republican consultants here in Washington. Even they admit that, you know, it is unlikely for Trump to win. And one of the things, interestingly, that they say is we are likely to see a scenario where in the first couple of days, Trump will try to deny the results of the election. Should he lose, he will try to hold on. But you're not going to see a whole lot of the Republican establishment sticking with them because they know what's at stake. It doesn't mean that you won't have hardcore supporters and that this thing, again, could turn quite violent and could create a significant amount of damage to our country's standing in the world, as well as obviously here at home.
Brett, and to that combustible atmosphere, we also have to add the potential for disinformation, misinformation, domestic and foreign. You were part really of almost an early warning system, as I recall, at the White House about foreign disinformation coming into the media sphere in the U.S. So you really saw that coming at an early stage. What's that like now in 2020?
Well, it goes back to this issue about the credibility of the process. And Russia, China, Iran would like nothing better than to undermine Americans' confidence in their institutions, in the process that we use to select a leader. So this is a ripe opportunity for them, not just, you know, as it was in 2016, to provide some strategic support to candidate Trump, but to really chip away at the confidence that Americans have in our institutions. And it has already been pretty battered over the last 3.5 years under Trump and his administration that have gone after even, you know, cherished institutions like the FBI and our intelligence services. But, you know, now you're looking at a scenario in which we will very likely see after Election Day, even on Election Day itself, massive efforts to create confusion, to introduce, you know, fake information, deep fake videos about what took place. And the hope, again, is that if Trump is himself trying to hold on to power, that all of this will work to amplify, to exacerbate that situation in those messages. And I do think that, you know, it is something we are likely to see continue should Joe Biden ascend to the presidency, that we'll have on the part of Russia and these other adversaries an effort to keep America divided. To, you know, as we saw in 2009 after Barack Obama was elected, the creation of a Tea Party-esque movement, but almost, you know, 100 times worse because, you know, the political dynamics now are even, you know, more polarized. They're even more potent. And so looking at a situation where there's a long game strategy, it's not just, okay, Election Day, immediate period after the Election Day, and even, you know, the inauguration, but how for the next 4 years can we really sow doubt and division and distrust? That's the objective.
that seems to be giving two different scenarios. And I'm wondering if you could help me work through them. One is that you see a bipartisan effort after the election to try to set up a firewall against that type of thing. So you've got some Republicans that are willing to work with Democrats in terms of, all right, how can we safeguard processes so it doesn't look like we have this confusion, this disruption? The other is that some of the more ardent pro-Trump voices that are in Washington, whether it's in the House like Jim Jordan or even the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, maybe Tom Cotton in the Senate, they'll dig in even deeper for Trump. And on top of that, if the Amy Coney Barrett nomination hearings go on after the election, that adds an extra layer. I guess what I'm saying is, do you expect the Republicans to actually come in and try to work with the Democrats against a possible foreign threat? Or are there still going to be those openings that can be exploited because you've got Trumpists who are dug in?
Well, I do think the Republican Party is going to be thrown into disarray after a Trump loss. The party has been so wholly consumed by Trumpism that it really will require a reckoning to look at what happened, how did they go forward. There's a lot of speculation that Trump may work to create his own political party. And I think we could see a scenario in which you have almost a Ross Perot-esque, independence party led by the former president and now obviously, his daughter Ivanka Trump is the heir apparent. And that the traditional Republican establishment works to shore up support, to reconstitute itself. And yes, potentially to reach across the aisle and find common ground that shows that they can govern again to regain some of those lost groups. I mean, the challenge from a Republican standpoint is if you look at demographics, they are going to lose not just in a decade or two, but in the next congressional elections, in the next presidential elections, the demographics are getting even worse for them. So they have got to figure out a course correction that allows them to get back to the center, that allows them to recapture, whether it is those suburban soccer moms, whether it's the working class middle of the country voters. And those voters are, currently the ones that are fleeing Donald Trump's party. I mean, if you look at how many older Americans have left Trump just in the last couple months, how many voters who were those Obama-Trump voters have gone back to support Joe Biden. I mean, those are the voters that have to be recaptured if the Republican Party is going to be salvageable.
Just a quick follow-up on that, Brooks. I'm really intrigued by this. If you turn around what you've been saying, look at more from the bottom up, in other words, not about whether Trump will go out and create another party, is a desire there for it? Is there such a thing as Trumpism, is I suppose what I'm asking, right? Is there an ideological movement that will go beyond 2020?
I think so. And very much familiar to those in Ireland and Europe, it's the Nigel Farage-esque, the notion of nationalism as the core precept of political ideology. And for Trump, it is not only a political, it is a business play. Let's remember that we've only a week ago learned that Trump has $400 million in debt that will come due. So he has to find a way to monetize his political position. And the way that he does it, according to observers, is to create, his own media empire. So you may see, essentially Fox News 2.0, the American Greatness Channel, and he will, attempt to turn the political support that he has had from his base into, a whole range of business entities, including that media entity. It will service a political ideology and the disenchantment that segment of America feels with the diversification of our country, with the internationalization of our country. So, Trump will essentially become the trumpeter in chief for the grievances of white, undereducated Americans.
let's assume we get a Biden administration that comes in. I'm not sure you would have much purchase if you get on a Trump second term. If there is a Biden administration, what are your top line recommendations in terms of repairing American image? Is it looking back across to Europe? Is there a global message you put across? Are there a couple of key cases that you focus on and go with those?
I think the first thing to appreciate is that America does not return to where we were before Donald Trump. Many, I think, around the world are hoping that somehow the United States will, you know, just enjoy that surge that came with Barack Obama's election in 2008. And yet, you know, even then, America didn't restore its credibility. It didn't restore its influence from where it was before George W. Bush. And I think the erosion has been even faster and farther. So Biden has to come in and try to cobble together coalitions. Yes, you know, the European Union, the UK, Japan, you know, some of our other traditional allies. And again, work with them to create a sphere of influence. Because what I've talked about in this concept of a post-American era is that you are going to have these various spheres of influence. You know, one certainly centered in China, one, you know, obviously around Russia and its, you know, near abroad and client states, as well as, you know, others, you know, from the developing world. The U.S. has to, you know, work with partners to create, I think, both new institutions that can be much more nimble, along with the repair of the old institutions. So one of my recommendations is let's not just go back to, you know, the old multilateral model, but how do we create a new model that isn't, you know, dependent on the pillars of great powers? Instead, there is this coalition that in its actions, a bit like, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was designed, but also from a political space to exert greater influence over and set standards and provide stability over a part of the world and to push some of the destabilizing countries like China and Russia into conformity with some of those standards and to pressure them in some ways, you know, as we did during the Cold War, to create a deterrent for some of their extracurricular activities, whether it's, you know, China trying to seize territory in the South China Sea or Russia trying to seize territory in its near abroad. I mean, all of these, I think, can only be taken on if you have a powerful coalition of countries.
Rhett, I want to thank you. We want to thank you for your clear, rational, calm reading of affairs in the United States at this time of considerable chaos. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
That's it for this episode of America Unfiltered. Be sure to listen to us on your favorite podcast platforms. Thank you for listening. I'm Liam Kennedy. Goodbye from Dublin.